everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Placer, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, my special guest from Artisans, Charles Amos.
Hello, everybody.
It's great to have you on. Hopefully things are going well for you with Artisans and keeping out this crazy heat wave we're having.
Yep, standing in my little work cave and fixing bugs and making features.
And we're going to be talking about Artisans later on in this cast. For this week, there's some news pieces that I wanted to talk about because we had a lot of interesting news happen over the weekend and from last week. So the first piece is regarding the whole Fez 2 fiasco. So for those of you who missed it, Fez 2 was apparently canceled by designer Phil Fish. And Phil Fish, as we know, has always had, I guess, somewhat of a volatile temper. Charles, did you hear when he said a thing about the Japanese game developers a few years ago?
Yes, I think so. Yes, he's an eccentric character.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think you also watched Indie Game Movie, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so that was another time we saw him pretty much get really frazzled by issues. So what happened, to make a long story short, was that the site Game Trailers, one of their people, I think Marcus Beer, he basically, on one of his shows, he said a lot of nasty things about Phil because he didn't want to respond about, I think it was, indie rights on Xbox. And then Phil basically responded on his Twitter feed by saying that he's packing up, Fez 2's canceled. And he basically said that this was just one in a long line of issues that he's had with the internet, with people downing him and insulting him, that he's just tired of.
Yeah.
This is one of those issues that it's hard to really find, you know, someone to support. On one hand, we have Phil, who, as we talked about, is not exactly, you know, the most nicest guy around. And then we have, on the other hand, the Game Trailer guy, who basically said all the stuff about him on his own show.
Yeah, neither one is good behavior. I do wonder sometimes with Phil, seeing, I think it was his little Twitter profile pic was Andy Kaufman for a little while. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if how much of this is a show and it's attention for, not attention's sake, but it's part of a larger scheme of some kind. And that Fez 2 may not be canceled, but instead just garnering more attention for its eventual release.
That's always possible. I mean, from what we talk about, he's definitely eccentric, but I think he is definitely intelligent. I don't think he's, you know, making these plans, he's moving spur of the moment. I think he definitely has some kind of long-standing plan with how he thinks.
Yeah, some machinations, possibly.
But I think the part that I just find a little distasteful, not so much about Phil Fish, but regarding the quote-unquote journalism of someone basically insulting a interview because he didn't want to respond to a question.
Yeah, that's not really journalism. I suppose it's editorializing. I watched a review of some Aliens Colonial Marines DLC recently that was not a review. It was just a little bit of a playthrough and then making fun of it. But it was sort of presented itself a little bit as game journalism, but of course not in a way that was fair. And possibly with something like Colonial Marines that's disappointed a lot of people, I think most of us are okay with it being made fun of sort of unfairly like that. But it still brings up that topic of game journalism as journalism, and should it be held to the same sort of ideal standards of objective journalism in other fields.
Yeah, we've definitely seen over the last few years a lot of, I guess, almost sensationalism journalism in terms of the game industry. We've had, you know, the personalities of Yahtzee, Jim Position, the Game Trailers guy, and even someone like Total Biscuit, who has these long videos, and it's very hard to see these things as being objective.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're let's plays often, right? It's like, here's me, a personality, I'm going to play the game and just tell you what I think. And I think a underlying piece to most game journalism has also been a should I buy it or not sort of product review, right? And that the reviews aren't necessarily the same as sort of a book review, in which it's not about whether you should buy it or not. It's whether this is a good piece of writing, you know, where it excels and where it falls. And often it seems like with the sort of 10-point ratings that come towards the end of most game reviews, that it's really more about whether you should buy the game or not, and not necessarily how this game holds up. In that sense, I actually like the Let's Plays with the personalities, because it feels closer to that friend who recommends a game to you or is just telling you about a game they played. And it's with all the ups and downs and with the struggles they had playing it and with what they loved and what they absolutely hate. And it, I guess because it's also more long form, some of those videos tend to get very long, especially Let's Plays that go through the whole freaking thing. It really gives you a much more nuanced look into all the aspects of it. They're just sort of a quick bullet pointed, you know, is it purchasable or not?
Definitely. That's always been one of the big debates regarding game reviews with the 10-point scale. If that is something that still needs to be there or if we should move away from that because it does sort of lock these reviews into these bullet point style things.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen a lot of people complain about everything from like IGN to just general, you know, if a game gets, you know, less than an 8, it's obviously, you know, a horrible game. There's no...
yeah.
And then if someone tries to use a whole scale, then it's like, how dare you lower the game's Metacritic score? You're a hack.
Right, right. Yeah, and those scores really affect sales quite a lot. Gamers are a savvy group that likes to research what they buy, especially since often the purchases are pretty big. So, yeah, if it's got a 7.0, why should I bother? But there are reasons you should bother sometimes. Sometimes, and actually somewhat often, there can be games that are not really that great. They're not really above a 7.0. But there's something in it that you just can't get anywhere else, and that's why you should play it, is because it provides a unique experience, despite if it's buggy or not well balanced, or, you know, it's not the smoothest experience. You know, when I was a kid, I would just go to, like, I think it was Stop and Shop and rent video games, and I would just rent whatever I hadn't played yet, and that meant I was playing the 2.0s and the 8.0s and the 5s, like, you know, all over the place, and some of those games were horrible, but, some of them, you know, even the bad ones were some of my favorite. And I worry now that I'm not playing enough bad games. Because I'm only playing the cream of the crop, right? I'm only, I think, like most gamers, waiting for the 9.0s or the 10s.
Yeah, I mean, just this week I was playing the game Expeditions Conquistador off of Steam from the Steam sale last week. And this was another Kickstarter game. And it wasn't, you know, the best game. There are definitely some bugs. The gameplay wasn't completely refined, but it had a really great setting taking place during the 16th century, where you basically lead an expedition from Spain to the New World, and there's this whole idea of trying to manage your followers while trying to basically keep your supplies up and deal with the issues going on. So it was a great idea, and I think, as you said, I wouldn't see this game as maybe like 7 on a traditional scale, but it did enough things right to provide a unique experience. And that's something that we really don't see too often, especially when we have a lot of major developers, I wouldn't say plagiarizing, but just following the same playbook with their designs.
Right, yeah. And, you know, the name of the game is fun, and unique experiences tend to go along with that, because if I'm playing my 400th first-person shooter, yeah, I'm having some fun, but, like, it's a little bit of a secondary fun, because it's a fun that I've had many times before. But yeah, to play a game and be doing something and seeing something on screen that I've never seen before that's challenging me in new ways, that's that primary fun, that fresh fun.
Yep, and we're definitely getting a reignite of that feeling, really thanks to Kickstarter, because a lot of the games we've been seeing that gets published that way are the games that wouldn't have been made by a AAA developer or a publisher because they didn't see it as, you know, being this multi-million dollar bestseller. It was just, you know, a niche game with a specific design that really would only interest, you know, hardcore fans or deal with a specific target.
Indeed, they're risky things. So yeah, indie games are more exciting now, in part because they're willing to take risks, because either it's a passionate team who doesn't care if they fail, or or there wasn't a lot necessarily invested. It's not a $60 million project. You know, maybe it's a couple thousand. So yeah, it lets you have the freedom to do it. And of course, the indie developers are inspired to do it because the AAA games aren't taking as many risks. So they say, well, then I'm going to take up the torch and do it myself.
Going back to what we were talking about a few minutes regarding the 10-point scale game reviews, one of the other issues when you have game reviews that have no ones, I know Computer Games or Windows Live, which I forget what they were actually was before that, they actually went pointless for a few months, and they found that people just didn't bother reading their reviews.
Yeah.
And it's always been that double-edged sword of, do you write towards the point score, or do you write towards just analyzing the game? and then, you know, just rolling a die to see what the actual score is.
Yeah, I wonder if what we're really talking about with scores, maybe this is just my own bias, is whether you should play it or not, right? And that's binary. It's either you should play it or you shouldn't play it. And I think if we move to that system, many reviewers would put games in the you should play it category that would have normally been sixes or sevens on a 10-point scale. And that might be actually better for the industry and better for gamers, that we'd play more games, we'd be a little bit more adventurous, and reviewers wouldn't have to go through this bullet point system where they're checking off boxes, but instead could just go with that gut feeling of, you should play this game. It's not the best game, but you should play it. And then when a game gets the, you shouldn't play this, that's a harsh review. It means, yeah, read this review in lieu of playing the game. You don't need to play it, just read this review.
Yeah, I think the two big problems, though, with that would really need to be dealt with by the whole industry. One is the fact that game prices aren't set in stone. We have, as we talked about, there's a $60 AAA games, we have $20 to $30 indie games, we even have, $4 to $5 games. And because of that, saying, buy this game or don't, it's different when you're talking about a $10 game from an indie team versus a $60 or even, what they're saying with the next generation, maybe $70 AAA game that costs $10 million to make.
Yeah, indeed. As soon as you say worth playing, you're bringing up worthiness and value. And I think, possibly the reviewer isn't necessarily equipped to say whether this is worth this amount of money or not, or if you could get this for cheaper. Imagine a review that says, this game is worth $20. It is currently $60, so wait until it's $20, and then it's worth your money.
Yeah, that would just be crazy.
Yeah.
And that's always, that's another trick, especially with a lot of sales going on. We've seen games, within a month to 2 months go from $60 to $40, or if it's during a big summer sale, go from $60 to $20, in that one day on the daily sale.
Mm-hmm. And that's when gamers like me and many others, especially on Steam, look at something and say, oh, yeah, I'll pick that up, especially in a bundle or with Humble Bundles, too. I think that's how a lot of games that wouldn't have been played otherwise get played, because you see the value there and you say, well, I'm saving so much money, It's that normal sale mentality. It's attractive because of all the money you're saving.
Yeah. So, Charles, during sales, I know we all have, an impulse buy threshold for games. What's your price that, if the game hits that point, you're going to buy it, you don't have to look at reviews, nothing like that?
Interesting. I'd say it's probably a percentage. If something is 75% off, first, I'm a little skeptical. I wonder why. But then it's often old games. And I say, I never played Arkham City or something like that. And now that the sales come up, it made me think about that again. That's maybe a game I missed out on, so I'm going to go back and get it. I think it's not necessarily a price. It's more of this being reminded of missed opportunities, of the games that I missed out on. But I'm not, I often don't get new stuff unless I know about it or I've watched some videos and I'm excited about it. But I don't know if I could say, a game comes up and I just have a visual, maybe a short description, that's only $1 and it just came out, I'm probably not going to buy that.
Yep. For me, I'm getting the same way too in terms of buying brand new games.
Yeah.
At this point, the only companies I really buy brand new day one from are usually like companies like Atlas or even someone like Nintendo if it's like a brand new game. So I know.
Yeah, you can trust those, right?
Yeah. And the fact that they usually retain their price value for a really long time. Or with Atlas, they throw in enough pre-order bonuses or special editions to sort of make it at least somewhat worth the $40 or $50 price tag.
Yeah.
And with Nintendo, their games it always seems like they're like one of like the last ones to actually go on sale these days.
Yeah, absolutely. They're always up there. I'm amazed to go back into GameStop or something and, look for first Mario for DS and see that it's still like $30. My guess is that's some sort of corporate policy they have that let's not devalue our products. We make some of the best video games in the world. Let's always have them be pretty premium. The other guys can put their games on sale, but we're not going on sale.
I think another thing that helps is that with companies like Nintendo and Atlas, they really don't put out a lot of video games compared to someone like EA or Activision.
Right.
So when they release them, one, there's that bit of excitement like, hey, it's a new Mario game, or hey, it's a new whatever game Atlas has, like Dragon's Crown yeah. coming out next week. And it's not like you're going to see the same exact game come out 5 more times over the next year. Usually when they release a game, you're not going to see something like that until maybe they decide to make a sequel in a few years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Atlas especially is a publisher with tons and tons of developers, because they often bring games from Japan to America, yeah?
Yeah. I know they do a lot of development in terms of the Shin Megami Tensei series, mm-hmm. but yet they also do publishing, although I know they're part of another company, which I believe they actually went bankrupt. It was either last week or the week before. So right now, things are still in flux about what's going to happen with Atlas, but I don't think you need to worry too much about them due to their name and brand quality, that if their parent company does fold, it shouldn't be too hard to find someone to keep Atlas going.
Yeah, looks like they are now a brand of Index Corporation, and they got acquired. Good yeah. old Wikipedia.
Now, going back to a few minutes ago, I was saying about the two problems with game reviews. I think the other issue is the fact that game design is such a subjective issue that it's very hard to say, you know, what makes a good first-person shooter? What makes a first-person shooter worth $60 or $30 or even $10? When you were talking a few minutes ago regarding book reviews, I mean, it's easy to read a book and say, you know, grammar is wrong, writing style is not right, but it's much harder to say this strategy game is a lot better than this one, or why people love StarCraft and not play whatever the hell, you know, a $10 RTS that just got released.
Yeah, I think reviews, you know, possibly like some book and movie reviews need to be highly contextual, like in what context are you reviewing this game? If you're reviewing a strategy game and say, well, it doesn't have enough first-person shooting in it, obviously that's a ridiculous thing to say. So chances are for, you know, a strategy game or a shooter, reviewing it in the context of other shooters, or where have we come from in the history of strategy games? Is this game a step forward or a step back? And I think you could be relatively objective with that. It's, of course, going to come down to opinion when it comes to whether you think these things are good. But my guess is there's some objective data in, has this been done before? What are the things that are attempted that are new? And you could probably, as a journalist, figure out from the community, is the community responding well to these changes? Are they skeptical of some? And maybe take the game and sort of dissect it from that perspective, from that contextual perspective, as opposed to the sort of context-free, this is just a good game, period, or this is a better game than this other one, apples and oranges comparison.
What are your thoughts on when we see game review who's not familiar with the genre review a game? Like, we've seen cases where an RPG person may review a first-person shooter,
right,
or a first-person shooter may review the latest Final Fantasy game, or something along those lines.
In those cases, it's as though that review, I'd say, is not invalid. But it is a review. If I am an RPG player mainly, and I'm thinking of getting into first-person shooters, I might want to read a review written by an RPG gamer reviewing an FPS. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it starts to get really niche at that point. But I do think, especially as games both have a branch that's going more casual and mobile and social, and a branch that's going even deeper into hardcore and more core, I think it is important to occasionally have a review, possibly you know, in a magazine or something that doesn't usually review games, to have an outsider come in and examine it. Because I think if we just have journalistic experts, you know, in their specific context, it starts to almost get academic, and it's a review just for the people who've been following strategy games and have played every single one. And so the reviewer can use all the jargon and language and refer to all these past games. But to someone new to games, period, or looking to get into a new genre, it might actually be very very difficult to read those and figure out what they're talking about. More than, I don't know if this is true more for games than other media, but certainly many different kinds of games have a tremendous learned lexicon of terms and strategies and metagame concepts behind them, possibly more than, you don't really have to learn how to watch a movie necessarily, unless you're going to film school or something, but you do have to learn how to play these games, and having a balance between sort of the expert reviews, in that sense, reviews written for experts, written for expert gamers, and these more open reviews written for, so you're new to games. Like, here's what's interesting about StarCraft to you. You're not going to be, you know, a diamond player winning tournaments, but you still may enjoy it. You shouldn't not play StarCraft just because you're not hardcore. That's something I worry about sometimes, is that some of these amazing, wonderful video games may never be played by most humans because they're sort of scared of them.
And I know in Japan there's that magazine Kotaku where all their reviews are basically split into three mini-reviews. Each one of their, I guess, writing staff reviews the same game. They each give it a score. So you do have that sense of having, you know, three different voices. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we really don't see in terms of Western or even European game reviewing. It's always done by one voice. But that would be interesting to have a novice and expert. But I think one of the problems, though, once again getting back to the whole number system, if you have someone who hasn't played the game actually give it a number score, or who's not familiar with the genre, the fans, of course, are going to clearly discount that review, saying he's not a first-person shooter fan. Why should we care what he says?
And my guess is you shouldn't. That review wasn't really for you. You know, it was for that audience member who hasn't played those games. And that for you, you need an expert. You need someone who has played the same games you have, is coming from the same perspective, has the same expectations as you, and what do they say about it? So I think that variety of reviews from many perspectives, it sounds like Kotaku does sort of a triangulation, you know, that you can start to get this full picture of where this game sits in the context.
Actually, yeah? I just don't want to interrupt you for one second. I definitely messed up when I said it's not Kotaku, it's Famatsu. That's the Japanese one.
Gotcha. So, yeah, I had a feeling.
Sorry, folks, if you're about to yell at me for, you know, saying good things about Kotaku, I apologize.
Is Kotaku American, but has a Japanese name?
Yeah, Kotaku's definitely American. Okay. I think they're based in Pennsylvania, at least when it first started, but I don't know where they're at right now. But yeah, folks, sorry about that. Don't yell at me for, you know, saying, yay, Kotaku.
Right, Famitsu. And they're the ones who end up with the multiple scores that then sort of get averaged, right?
Yeah. And they're considered one of, like, the cream of the crop in terms of reviews in Japan. One of the things I've seen in the past is that if a game gets, like, a 90 or above from Famatsu, the American gamers know, you know, definitely keep your eye on that if it gets ported. I think Xenoblade Chronicles on the Wii got a very high score from that. That was one of the really fireworks moments for that game to get over to the United States.
Yeah, and they do love their Monster Hunter. Every Monster Hunter gets a pretty high Famitsu score.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I want to talk about is when you mentioned in terms of game terminology, that's always another tricky aspect. And that's one of those things that is dependent on the expertise of the actual game reviewer. I know with myself, even though I try to use a few game terms, there's still a lot of it that I don't know. And part of that is the industry is so big that every corner or every genre has its own unique vernacular to describe things. And it can sometimes be difficult to know, you know, am I saying this right, or is this the layman's term? Is this the term for the expert? And I even got corrected on Gamasutra last week with just that, when I wasn't familiar with the term negative feedback loop or positive feedback loop. And I haven't heard that in my own circle, so I didn't know about that. But that was a case where there was already a pre-established term that many people may not know of. And when you're trying to write towards the expert, when you're trying to write towards a novice, it can be difficult to strike that balance between the two.
Yeah, for sure. And for something like the positive and negative feedback loops, a lot of these are coming from outside of gaming, too, whether they're logic or mathematical or statistical terms coming in, because games are such a hodgepodge of all different media. So you could have sophisticated musical terms coming in, visual art terms, animation terms, programming terms, and that's a whole lot to juggle. And chances are, if you actually used all of them in one review, you're going to lose every reader at some point.
Yeah.
I think, you know, depending on where you're writing from and who your audience is, writing to that audience obviously is the number one goal. And I'd say be, you know, better safe than sorry, and go with assuming that they don't know these terms and only using jargon when needed, because it is required for the context of the game, or it's required to explain something unique about the game, and then defining it. Because really, there's no harm in using a fancy term if you define it as well.
Definitely. And with the reviews I do here on Game Wisdom, I try to keep it more I guess, somewhat in the middle between expert and novice. And I don't do any kind of game scores here because I figured that because I focus specifically on the game design elements, that I'm not really in a position to stick a score on games. I judge this a 9 or I judge this a 2. And I think it does help keep the authenticity of the piece better because of that. But at the same time, I know that I'm not going to strike it big on Metacritic or have, you know, thousands of people read because I gave a game a 4 or I gave it a 10.
Right, yeah. A lot of those times, different sites will give something a provocative score, whether it's, you know, giving something a 10, oh, everyone's going to rush to that review to see the perfect game. Or, yeah, if you give a game that was expected to do very well and others rated it well, a low score, you can attract people to your site that way. Yeah, and both of those feel ingenuine. You know, it's, you're using the score not as what a score is sort of meant to do, which, you know, may not even be good, but you're instead using it as this lure of, hey, come over here, we have something provocative to say about this game. You can go to any other site and read the 9.0 review, but here's where the 10.0 review is.
Definitely. So before we move on to the next point, just to bring this back to the whole Phil Fish, Marcus Beer debate, like I said in the beginning, I don't think there really is a clear winner here. On one hand, we have Marcus, who basically antagonized Phil. On the other hand, we have Phil, who has never really been a positive example. So I think, in the end, I hope that Phil does calm down. I hope he gets back to doing it, because a lot of people enjoyed Fez. I think to deprive them of, you know, a new game when they were willing to put up with him and deal with all the issues, I just don't think that's right. In terms of Marcus and the sensational journalism, I really hope that we start to move away from that. We start seeing more quality pieces and less, I guess, troll bait pieces.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and I hope if Phil does leave gaming, it's not because of the public spotlight and the feedback that he gets from fans. I hope it's because he doesn't like making games anymore, you know, because he is really good at what he does, and people really do like what he does, too. They may not like him personally or what he says, but I think they really do like his games. And, yeah, to not make Fez 2, it seems like just make Fez 2 and be a recluse. Like, don't talk to anybody and just make your little game and have people play it and really enjoy that. And he may find that really rewarding. And yeah, I guess the reason I feel that way is, seems like a shame for someone to leave their craft, not because they no longer like their craft. That should be the only reason you leave it, is because you don't like working in games anymore. But it seems more like he doesn't like PR. And so yeah, leave the PR craft. but keep staying in game design.
Definitely. Alright, so moving on, another bit of news that came last week is just a, I guess we could call it like a major Kickstarter fiasco, was with the board game The Doom That Came to Atlantic City. So what happened with this was, when the Kickstarter was put up in May of last year, they're asking for $35,000 to do a board game. I didn't follow this personally, so I don't know the exact details of the gameplay. But it was sort of like, from what I saw, a mix of Monopoly with almost like Lovecraftian themes to it.
Yeah.
So they're asking, of course, $35,000, and they made $122,000. So obviously they got way more than what was intended. Over the last year, they've had update after update, you know, saying, you know, the game's going well, or, you know, there's been a slight delay of the printer, but we're still on track. Nothing, you know, doom and gloom or apocalyptic. And then all of a sudden, last week, on their 27th update, the owner came on and said, the game is done. We're out of money. We're shutting down. I'm sorry. We can't basically keep up our end of the bargain. Obviously, a lot of people were upset. And I guess to add fuel to the fire, the owner promised that there was going to refund the money, of course. But because of the Kickstarter obligation versus pre-order obligation, they're going to deal with the pre-orders first come and then, you know, start getting money to the Kickstarter people, hopefully, you know, at some point in the future. And this is just really one of those issues that I was sort of talking about last year. I think when you were on the cast the first time, regarding the dark side of Kickstarter, of what happens when projects fail and people basically lose their confidence in the program.
Yeah.
And the other part that was just revealed a few days ago, as people started digging up more about the owner, was what kind of happened with the money. And part of it seems like he just had a horrible time managing it. And then there's some just shadier issues. Like, For instance, he said that when they got the funding last year, he basically quit his job, moved to Oregon, and basically bought a house, set up a studio. And while setting up the studio and getting something on that front, you know, that's expected in terms of a Kickstarter. But the whole idea that he used Kickstarter funds to quit his job and then use that to buy a house doesn't seem all that right.
No.
And according to this, the two other people of the company, the artist, and I think, I forget the other guy, what his role was, they have not seen any of the Kickstarter money yet. It's all gone to the owner. And it just sounds more and more shady. So, I guess for my first question for you, Charles, is when you hear stories like this, do you think that these kinds of stories are going to become more commonplace on Kickstarter? Or do you think that these are just, you know, the unintended bumps on such a new type of funding?
That's a good question. I think they will become more common, but in part that's because Kickstarter will just become more popular. And so there will be more projects, and with more projects, there's going to be more cut and run stuff. I think backers will get better at their sort of due diligence in figuring out if a project is actually going to come to fruition or not. Since every time you back it, that's a vote of confidence and trust. You're saying, I believe you will not steal my money. I believe you're actually going to make the thing that you said you were going to make. And in most cases, that's true. Definitely, that is the majority. And then there are cases like the Doom that came to Atlantic City, in which, regardless of what is truly happening behind the scenes, the truth is that it sounds like the game's not going to come out, right? So whatever they did with the money, even if they spent it very well and spent it all in the game, but just weren't able to finish, and they ran out of money, and what they've produced is just not a viable product. You couldn't even send it to backers for some reason. It disintegrates into your hands. Regardless, the truth is that the game's probably not going to come out. Although it sounds like someone's going to try to get something out there at some point.
Yeah, it really is hard to say at this point. I think in terms of ownership, it definitely is up in the air. Because I think the two other people of the company, I think they've gotten litigation going against the owner regarding who owns what's left of the project.
Yeah.
And there's that whole thing about, you know, what's going to happen to the $122,000 that was made.
Oh, I'm sure it does not exist. I'm sure it is now in many people's hands. Yeah, it sounds like some of the guys in the project want to create a print and play form for the backers. So yeah, in general, I think that's going to happen more often, but just because the volume of projects will increase. I think backers will get more savvy. I don't know if there will be, if Kickstarter will institute any more accountability. You know, they essentially, their accountability right now amounts to, you have to write in a risks and challenges section, but you get to write it, and you could say, absolutely no risks and challenges involved.
yeah, and that's another sticky point. That's actually just what I was going to talk about next in terms of Kickstarter protection. As we all know, in terms of Kickstarter, once that project hits 0 seconds and it's funded, all the money immediately transfers to the owner, mm-hmm. whether that's, you know, $5,000, $5 million. And another, I guess is somewhat of a lesser known fact, is that when you hit the last 24 hours of a Kickstarter, all pledge money is basically locked in. So once you get underneath 24 hours, anyone who's pledged, you can't basically unpledge if the project is considered a success.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize.
So there's definitely that strategy that we've seen with a lot of Kickstarters, and that's sort of where that last 24-40-hour rush really comes from, because that's when things get real. That's when that money is going to hopefully be used rather than being, you know, a promise or a pre-order application.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in terms of Kickstarter, one thing some people are talking about is, should Kickstarter give the full amount to the owner, or should they, you know, divvy up month by month or a quarter by quarter basis? As someone who had a successful Kickstarter, what do you think on that? Do you think it would be better to split the money up, or do you think that in terms of actually getting a product done, that having that full lump right from the start is an important part?
Well, that's something I haven't thought about. Well, I would say certainly right away, there's nothing we needed that lump sum for right away in the beginning. You know, obviously, maybe not obviously, we pay for our freelance artists and animators 2 weeks at a time, just like, you know, most people get paid. And, you know, so we end up with a lot of money in our bank account, the artisan's bank account, that just solely trickles out to our artists. And that's all we're using the money for right now. So the idea of, instead, our bank account gets a little bit of money You know, maybe just enough for the month or so or whatever we set our budget was. Maybe we have to provide a budget to Kickstarter. It's kind of crazy that you don't have to do that, but, maybe you provide a budget and then the money gets released over time. My question would be, that sounds like there's some sort of monthly check-in as well. And then the backers say, okay, you get your next month. And at any point, the backers can say, oh, nope, you have not met expectations. We have, stopped your trickle of money. And then, supposedly, I guess backers get a refund of whatever's left. That definitely strikes the chord of accountability. You're now incredibly accountable to backers.
Yeah.
Because they're controlling your paycheck. But that also means being at their expectational whim could be dangerous too.
Definitely. And that also really would bring crowdfunding more back into, you know, the publisher developer mindset of, you know, if you're not appeasing the publisher, voila, your money's gone.
Indeed,
you know?
Yeah. So now you've got the publisher of the masses. Oh dear. Oh dear.
Yeah. And that also raises the point on projects that basically barely meet their funding versus stuff like the board game, the Doom That Can't Like Say, that went way over their funding. And what we've been seeing is that when we have these cases where a project not only meets but beats their expectations dramatically, that the fans, they want more. They have a higher quality they're expecting from the Kickstarter when, you know, hey, we're going to buy this game at $35,000, but, you know, if you're going to get $120,000 or, you know, $500,000,
yeah,
we expect a lot more. We want to get our money's worth.
Right. That's not just going to buy you a house that needs to somehow improve your product. Yeah, that is challenging, especially if you raise a tremendous amount over what you planned on and you don't really have a scalable project. With Artisans, we scale very easily and we plan on, you know, continuing production and making money through future sales and continuing to grow the game. So when we raised a little bit more than what we asked for, we can pretty easily just put that into expanded content.
Now, here's a question. I think I asked this of you last time, but when we have projects like FTL that they went, you know, I think they got several thousand times more than what they were asking for the game, but they didn't use that to dramatically improve the game. They basically kept within the scope, kept within what they promised on Kickstarter. Do you think games need stretch goals, or do you think that if you're saying, I'm promising, you know, 5 levels, 10 hours of content, regardless of how much money I get, that's what you're getting. Do you prefer one or the other, or do you think it's a case-by-case type basis?
I'm always a fan of case-by-case, can't lose. But I would say stretch goals, I think, are not a great thing for game design. Most games are not designed to be stretched. Or say, oh, we were going to add this dungeon if we had a bunch of money. But if we don't have that money, we just won't add it. And that will be okay too. It's very rare that a game can not meet goals and just dump that stuff. And, you know, some game designers might disagree and say there's always stuff on the cutting room floor. There's always stuff that if we had the budget, we'd love to do. So stretch goals are perfect for that. That lets us do those that extra set of animations that make turning around look better. Of course, that's not a sexy stretch goal, but it is, you know, the kinds of things where companies have to cut corners because it's just not worth the cost to get that in there. So strangely enough, stretch goals would probably be always it's always the fat, right? If without meeting any of the stretch goals, you have a great game, self-contained, then when you stretch, all you're probably adding is stuff that doesn't need to be there, making them a little less compelling to me as a backer. But at the same time, your point about FTL and others, when they raise a lot more than they asked for, but don't really have that much in the way of stretch goals or don't really plan on expanding the game because, you know, maybe the game is already designed, it's very tight, and they don't want to have anything that wouldn't necessarily be in there. Artisans felt that way a bit. So our stretch goals were more like exclusive pets for people, as opposed to saying, we're now going to add content that we wouldn't have otherwise added. That's tricky.
It's definitely a slippery slope that we've been seeing. Well, I know with the Stonebar Kickstarter that I actually pledged to a few months ago, they started with just, you know, build a city using like that blocky, almost like that game 8-Bit Hero type style. And that was all. And then they just kept adding more and more stretch goals. So now they got multiple factions, a lot more characters. So, I mean, from what they start with and what they end up with are two very different things in terms of scale and design. And as you said, it is dangerous to stretch a game that far. Because, one, you probably didn't think about that. I mean, you can say, you know, oh, I had murmuring to myself, I would like, you know, procedurally generated open world gameplay, but I don't know what that is yet, but, you know, give me money and maybe I'll think about
yeah,
it.
Maybe
stuff
I'll think
like
about
that.
It. Yeah, often I'm also skeptical that the amount of money contained within the stretch goal itself, you know, whatever it was since the last stretch goal, is actually enough to fund what they're talking about. Not for that project in particular, but I've just seen others that say, you know, oh, you know, we'll make a mobile version of the game. It's some, like, you know, AAA 3D thing that is not going to be easy to port to mobile. And the stretch goal only was a span of about $5,000. So they're somehow going to do that for $5,000.
Yeah. It's definitely sometimes hard to tell exactly, is the money they're saying accurate, or is it just eye in the sky, kind of, they're just guessing. And that raises another point. We've seen two different types of stretch goals. There's the ones that are technical or quality of life ones, and then there's the game ones. And we just talked about the gameplay ones, but what are your thoughts on, like, technical stretch goals? You know, like, if we get enough money, we're going to port this to Steam, we're going to port this to Android, we're going to get a Wii version of it, or, you know, the stand, this is the amount that we're just going to make the whole game better. We're going to make graphics better, give it better animations, better sound, those types of goals.
Yeah, I could see a polished stretch goal. Sort of sounds what it's like. Mm-hmm. We're going to improve all these things. Or porting stretch goals, those make some sense to me as well. But, yeah, typically you'll want to reach certain platforms regardless of, you know, whether that's a stretch goal or not. But it does take money to port things, and if you don't yet have that money, it could be hard to do that. I think also with these game projects, I think in some cases what they raise on Kickstarter is truly enough to build the entire game start to finish. And if they never raise another dime, or they never make any money on selling the game somehow, the only people who get it are their backers, that would be enough and is fine. And so if they don't reach those stretch goals, that means those things are never going to happen. But I think for most game projects, Kickstarter is just the beginning. It's those first adopters who you didn't even have a game. You just had a pitch, and they were willing to back you. And you use that money to get to a stable step, whether it's a demo or whatnot, and give that out to your backers. But hopefully then you're making a product you can sell to people who didn't back your game and start to raise more money. Or I think some games may even go on to get a traditional publishing relationship after proving that they have some viability through Kickstarter, sort of semi-indie. And I think there are others that may raise investment money as well after Kickstarter. So with those, stretch goals start to seem a little curious to me too, because if you get that money from somewhere else, will you add it? Or because it didn't reach that stretch goal threshold back then, that means now you'll never add it, even if you get more money later.
Yeah, and that's a good point regarding what happens to these stretch goals when they fail. Do they just disappear into the sunset, never to be seen again? Or are they, you know, left on the table as, you know, hey, we sell the game and make an extra $100,000, we can add them in. And that's why I was actually wondering with Expeditions Conquistadors that we talked about way earlier in the cast, was the game was funded. I think they asked for, I think, $65,000 or $70,000. I think they made $77,000.
Yeah.
But they had stretch goals on top of that. They had, you know, the standard, you know, better graphics one. They had a third campaign. They even had one where they would add more balance and systems to the characters. And those goals did not succeed.
Yeah.
So what happens then? I mean, when you have goals like that, that would fundamentally make the game better or more worth it, do you just, you know, never talk about them again? And I think from what I read on the Steam forums, that the game hasn't actually earned enough money yet to justify basically working on those stretch goals, which is a big shame.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, so I suppose in that sense, if a stretch goal is reached on Kickstarter, you can more or less promise it to your backers and to your future customers. And if it's not reached, then you say, one day in the future we may reach this, but now it can't be promised. I see the first stretch goal for Conquistador is choosing passive abilities for your followers every time you level up. That to me seems like either that is an important thing to the game's design, or it's not important and it's just stapled on there. So they're not going to have that, supposedly. And it'd be a funny thing to add after the fact, possibly, I mean, depending on how passive abilities work. But then they've got greater visual variation and some things like that. Those make more sense to me. I guess when you have a stretch goal that would change the sort of core of your gameplay, and you don't reach that, or you do reach that, that's when I'm a bit skeptical. But I'm a game designer, so of course I would be. An artist might be like, greater visual variation? What? That's going to change the whole visual aesthetic of the game. Like, we didn't make them look ugly on purpose, you know?
Yeah. Now, another thing that we've been seeing in terms of Kickstarter over the last few months are companies basically double-dipping. We have Double Fine, who last year they had the Double Fine Adventure game, which, ironically, they ran out of money on that, and then they just had another Kickstarter for Massive Chalice. And also, last week when we talked with Bobby King from Farsight on the Pinball Arcade, Farsight has been making heavy use of Kickstarter to basically fund the getting the rights for their pinball tables, because that is a lot of money when you're trying to secure the rights for, you know, Twilight Zone or Terminator 2. So they're up to 3 Kickstarters. Their last one just succeeded last week, and then they're also in the steps of preparing for a 4th Kickstarter. So for them, having these multiple Kickstarters is a great thing. But I guess for you, Charles, what do you think about game companies who use Kickstarter multiple times? Do you think that is sort of betraying the concept of Kickstarter, or do you think that it is all right for a company to say, hey, you know, we just finished our first Kickstarter game, now would you like to fund our next game?
I think it can be done well. I think, imagine this. Imagine a company that doesn't do any games unless they're Kickstarter. And for them, that's a way of essentially vetting those ideas and saying, hey, is this game idea even worth working on? We're going to put out 5 Kickstarters all at once, and you guys back the ones you like, and hopefully a bunch of them fail, and one or two succeed, and we're going to work on those instead. And then, you know, when they are thinking of doing another game, they do the same thing and use Kickstarter as a way of testing new ideas to see if they're viable, as opposed to, I think right now it could be that a lot of the high profile projects don't fail enough, and maybe they're not asking for enough money, and that way they usually succeed because they can raise a little bit. It seems like, especially when it comes to things like Double Fine and some of the big projects, we back because we're fans of the creators and not necessarily because we're specifically excited by this idea. With Double Fine Adventure, what was the pitch for that game?
I think it was pretty much them saying, we want to make a classic adventure game. We have, you know,
just
Ron
some
Gilbert.
Classic adventure game, but made by awesome dudes, like the masters of adventure games. So you don't know what the game's going to be at all. So we're not pitching you the game. We're just pitching you the process. And it would be great if we moved further away from that and didn't pitch the developers and the teams, but we actually pitched the ideas for the games themselves. And, you know, a little bit more like Steam Greenlight in the would you buy this or would you not? And then I think it's totally okay for a company to come back time and time again, as long as they're pitching their games and not their company.
Yeah, that is definitely a good point. We see a lot in terms of the high-profile Kickstarters that they're just saying, hey, I want to make a shooter game. Give me money. And then you have, you know, indies and small developers who actually get as far as building a prototype or having, you know, early gameplay footage saying, you know, this is what we have so far. If we get the money, we're going to expand on this, and it's up to you. And I think that, and as you said, I think we do need to get away from having Kickstarters work just on name alone. That they do need to produce some kind of content or something to show people just what exactly is their money being put towards.
Yeah, definitely.
And would be interesting, as you said, having a company that just works entirely off of Kickstarter. One, if that would actually be feasible, and two, just seeing that dynamic work. And it would be nice to see, you know, more developers go that route. But then again, we also have to deal with the issue of consumer confidence. If they get 3 Kickstarter projects and all 3 turn out horrible, they're not going to obviously be funded for a 4th game.
Yeah, and that's curious to me. I mean, perhaps, like you say, that's a lack of confidence in the company. And yeah, this sounds like a really cool game idea and pitch. I just don't believe that you guys can pull it off. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, I totally understand. But my worry would be that I didn't like your last game. So even though this game sounds way cooler and much better, I'm not going to back it because I didn't like your old stuff.
Yeah, and that's another issue when we have companies do multiple Kickstarters, how what you do in the first or second Kickstarter can come back to bite you with later Kickstarters. With Farsight, he talked about how they had issues with fulfilling, you know, the extra orders or the higher Kickstarter pledges, and that kind of stuff came back to really hurt them during the first half of the Kickstarter, because everyone was saying, you know, hey, I still haven't gotten what I pledged last time. Why should I give you more money now?
Yeah, indeed. It's a good question.
All right, and one last question for you before we move on. There's still that debate over, is Kickstarter more of a, you know, donation charity, or is it, you know, a investment deal. Like, you're investing in someone's idea, you expect a product. And there's definitely arguments for both sides. Because when we see with a lot of these bigger failures, when someone doesn't get their game, they're obviously going to be mad. But when you're giving $10 to someone, you know, on just an idea alone, do you have the right to be outright furious that it didn't work? So, from your opinion, Charles, where do you stand on, is it an investment or is it more of a charity donation Kickstarter?
I think it lies somewhere in the middle and more towards the investment side. I think you're definitely, and not an investment, but more towards the a purchase for a good. It's not a store necessarily. I know Kickstarter strongly wants it to not be a store. It is more of a vote of confidence and trust, but it's not a charity in the sense that your money is now just gone. You may get something back for it if the developer is nice to you. But no, I think the expectation is that you pledge money for a project and, you know, you pick a reward because you expect to get it. And if you don't get it, not only do I think the backer has a reason to be angry, obviously, but I don't know if they deserve a refund necessarily. If it's a refund policy, then it definitely is a store, right? You just made a purchase essentially on Amazon or eBay, and the person that you bought it from didn't sell you the product. Of course you deserve a refund. And that's why it's more in the middle ground of some projects can fail, and there's no way of necessarily knowing exactly what's going to happen to a project when they set out. And sometimes things fail for a good reason and aren't able to be finished, and the money is gone and there's no room for refunds. Then I think there are examples of foul play where they never intended to make the product and it really was just a pitch to get money, and then they've taken it and used it on other things. In those cases, I think legal action makes some sense because goodwill has been destroyed there, and they really did mean to mislead you into paying for something that you were never going to get. But in cases where a team tries their hardest, stays up to date with their backers, you know, updating them once a month or something, and tells them about the struggles and whatnot, I think Double Fine has been very good about that. And then they run out of money and are not able to deliver. I think that's the what can happen on Kickstarter that in some ways is the worst, because it doesn't even let backers can be furious, but I mean, who can they really blame?
Definitely. Now, when Kickstarter first started to really get off the ground, as we talked about before, there wasn't a section for, you know, risks and challenges for a project.
Yeah.
And then as more projects started to fail and we saw more, I guess, shadier ones start popping up, they instituted that change. Do you think Kickstarter will, I guess, in light of what we've seen over the last few months or even to the end of the year, do you think there'll be any more changes to their policy? Or do you think they're going to keep things the way it is?
I think that depends a lot on the community and what the outrage looks like, and how many people just blame the creators of projects, or do they blame Kickstarter a little bit for not vetting projects more? The risks and challenges section, to me, because the creator gets to write it themselves, and I don't know how much Kickstarter actually reads those and approves them or not, I don't know if it's actually doing much. It's so far down on the page. It's the last thing.
Yeah.
I think many backers don't read it at all. I think they watch the video, maybe glance a little bit, scroll through, look at the pictures, and then back it or not. But risks and challenges should almost be the first thing.
Yeah.
If Kickstarter is about, I'd say it's about two things on the primary level. It's about a pitch and the trust for whether or not you think I can deliver on this pitch. So having things like budget breakdowns, I think, would make more sense to include. Also, maybe risks and challenges being questions from backers, instead of me just getting to say, oh, yeah, no, there's no risks and challenges, or like, this will be a piece of cake, don't worry about it. Having a backer ask a specific question, or maybe asking what the timeline is, asking that tricky stuff. And I think if you have satisfying answers to that, and maybe can back it up or prove it, that'll build even more trust and probably get your project even more money. And it'll give the right projects more money, and the wrong projects, hopefully, people can read that stuff and either withdraw their pledge if they've already pledged or not pledge at all.
Definitely. And that kind of consumer confidence, that trust, is a big deal. And we can definitely see a big difference between the Kickstarters that work, that, you know, get that confidence, versus the ones that are just, you know, very shady, that it just seems like they're just trying to get money that we're never going to hear from them again.
Yeah.
All right. So enough with the doom and gloom for today. I think we've had enough of that. Let's use that as a springboard to talk about a Kickstarter that has succeeded. very well your own Kickstarter, Artisans. So, Charles, how is everything going with Artisans?
Slow but steady. We are getting really close to our first playtests, where we're going to playtest just the combat section of the game and get our first Kickstarter backers in playing that. You know, it's taken a little longer than we expected. We're off by maybe about a month, I'd say. But nothing, you know, that's sort of shaking the core or anything like that. We're just running into bugs and implementing more features that we weren't sure if we'd need, and now find that we definitely do need them. And we want to get a pretty polished experience, even for this early playtest, so that our first players can really enjoy the game and judge it based on the fun and feel of the combat and not be so concerned about running into a little animation bug that makes them look funny.
Now, for people who have forgotten about Artisans, could you just briefly remind them about what exactly Artisans is?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a online multiplayer 2D action game, which you can join up with three friends and fight and hunt monsters. But also you can build all of your own equipment, helmets, swords, boots, grappling hooks, and actually draw what they look like yourself and customize them with mods to give them unique functionality. So the character that you play in Artisans is either fully drawn by you or from art that you pick up from friends or in the store, but you look exactly how you want to look, and all of your behavior is customized too. So you there's no classes, you build your own little custom guy, and then you go on these missions together with your friends to fight monsters that are extremely challenging, very smart, and adapt to your behavior.
Now, I forgot you answered this last time, but in terms of content, is there like a end quest or big final boss, or does the game just keep going on with more quests and more content as it is added?
We have a semi-randomized mission system, so you're always given six missions, and they change every, I think, like 45 minutes or so. Each mission has like its own time duration. But the difficulty of those missions is based on your own skill rank, which is how many missions you have won in the past versus lost. And every time you lose a mission, your skill rank goes down. When you win, it goes up. And we continue to make the missions harder by mixing and matching content, by tweaking the stats on guys, and not in just a, oh, all of your monsters now do more damage, but in sneakier ways, by upsetting your expectations. A slow monster will now be faster than expected, or a monster that used to attack more often blocks more often. But there's two monsters of that same type, or a combination. You know, we start to mix things up and give you greater challenges as your skill rank increases. And we really don't want there to be an end mission. We want to continue to challenge you. And as we add new content, the possible combinations of that of those randomized missions and random builds get greater and greater. If we add a new weapon or we add a new monster, suddenly the possibilities get a lot bigger.
And it was definitely interesting. Since you guys ended the Kickstarter and have worked on the game, has the scope of the project changed at all? Have you added in any new gameplay content from the Kickstarter, or have things been relatively stable?
I think because we raised more than we were expecting, we tried to raise 30,000, we raised about 52. We knew that we had a little bit more time in the beginning to do a larger refactor on our scripting systems and our animation system, instead of going right into making new content. That, in part, is why we're a little bit behind schedule, because we put that refactoring time in early. But that's going to pay off as we move forward, and it already is. The changes we made to scripting are making our mods easier. The mods are, as opposed to sort of normal game mods, are the things that make your equipment different. We made that more streamlined. We integrated Spine, which is actually another Kickstarter project. It's a 2D bone and hinge-based animation system that we're using in Artisans now, and that's working really, really well. I think without Spine, we wouldn't be able to not only make it look as nice as it's going to look, but there's a lot of things that we couldn't do. For instance, dynamic angular, like shield aiming as you're running along, because that needs to actually mix and blend a bunch of animations. Whereas previously you needed to stop when you blocked, you couldn't run while blocking, and you could only aim your block in like diagonal up or forward. And now it follows the mouse. It can be any direction. You can do it while running, while jumping. So Spine's really helped us blend all those animations together, and raising more money helped us get a little bit of time to just focus on that refactoring.
It definitely sounds interesting. Now, as we talked about a few minutes ago regarding other Kickstarters, that as long as the Kickstarter, you know, they're keeping the pledgers happy, they're keeping them updated, that you sort of get that wiggle room if there are any hiccups. With Artisans, since you said that you're about a month behind, How are the fans handling it? Like, are they? We've seen cases where fans get pretty upset. Have they, you know, been relatively mild?
Yeah, our fans are great. They're very understanding, and it's clear that really what they want, they just want the game. They want the game to be great. So as long as they really feel like we're always moving the needle forward and we're always working as hard as we can at, which we absolutely are, then I think they're very understanding. What they don't like is not being told what's going on and feeling like they're not sure what we're doing. So every time we come back to them and tell them how progress is going, they're always very thankful for that. And have new questions, want to see how things are developing, have suggestions. But they've been great. And I'm actually very thankful for being a successful Kickstarter project to have that community that does care about the ongoing production of the game. So we don't just, languish in obscurity that nobody even knows we're making a game and we're not sure if anyone likes it. It's great to be able to show them progress and hear that they're still excited.
Has Artisans managed to get greenlit yet on Steam?
We're still in the concept section, so okay. That doesn't really involve the greenlit. You have to have a fully playable prototype, or at least Steam really recommends it, a fully playable prototype before you end up on main greenlight. So once we have that and really feel confident in that, that's when we'll hit greenlight, and we'll want to do it at the same time we send demo builds to press and things like that, so that we can build up a lot of attention around it. I think it's hard on greenlight if you don't get a whole lot of votes right in the beginning in order to get your game in the top 100. If you don't get that pretty quickly, once again, you just sort of fall into the abyss, which can happen on Kickstarter too. Your project is on there, but nobody's going to see it. It's not popular. It's not staff pick. It's not anywhere. You can't even search for new game projects if you wanted to find it.
Yeah, and that is another real killer of a lot of Kickstarter projects. If the company isn't really good with PR in terms of getting their name out there. I know with Farsight, they definitely had some PR issues in the beginning where they didn't have any updates for like the first 15 days of the Kickstarter.
Wow.
And especially with Kickstarter, with any kind of high-profile project, you really need to have a dedicated PR person get on, you know, every day or multiple times a day to get that word out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that we've been seeing with a lot of Kickstarters and early projects is having multiple buy-in versions, the standard edition, the fancier edition, stuff like that. With Artisans, when the game is actually released, are you planning on having like multiple editions of the game, or will just have the one standard edition for everyone?
Well, the Kickstarter backers have some, they're not really different editions, but they'll get different new content in the beginning. Like I think the Pioneers get a full set of like custom armor and weapons, things like that. But it doesn't lead to a different version of Artisans.
Okay.
Maybe in the future we might have like... some sort of premium account that could get you some new special stuff, some new features in your workshop or things like that. But I think for a good long time in the beginning, we're probably just going to want to have everyone playing the same game. And definitely balance and fairness are important to us. I'm sure they're important to every game, but but for us, we don't really have a leveling up system and that makes you objectively better. Or, you know, you're level 45, so you do more damage. And it's much more skill-based, and the equipment that you put on has balanced pros and cons. So because of that, we can't really make a version in which someone has sort of better armor than somebody else.
Now, a few minutes ago, you talked about how great your fans are in providing support, providing ideas for Artisans. Have there been any major changes added to the game that were from the fans?
Yeah, I'd say when they ask for something, like they were asking for a preview of how the canvas system works, like how do you draw the appearance for things? And we were thinking of just waiting and releasing the final workshop when they get to do that. But because a lot of them were asking to see that early and they didn't mind like drawing just in Photoshop or in whatever they use and maybe getting a preview of how it would work and so they can get a head start on drawing helmets and swords and whatnot, we did release a preview of that because they asked for it. And, you know, in the comments, we get to see links to people's early drawings. And I don't think that's something that we would have done unless they had asked for it. And, you know, many people asked for it.
Cool. All right. I think we're going to start wrapping up here. So before we end it, in terms of Artisan's release, when are you shooting for the public version of the game?
Public version, that's tough. I think we're going to, as we add content to our playtests, starting with combat and just Kickstarter backers, and then adding workshop onto that for creating your own stuff and adding missions onto that, we'll build that up slowly and bring in more of our Kickstarter backers and then start to bring in the public. And I'd say we'll probably be bringing in public players in the fall and And, you know, of course, the playtest version of the game is going to get better and bigger and bigger until I think we'll have a pretty robust demo that looks like an alpha, probably towards the end of the year.
Cool. And we talk about how it's still not on Steam yet. Have you looked at any other distribution platforms for getting Arsons on it?
Ah, Steam's such a beast. It accounts for, you know, a huge amount of PC game sales, especially indie. So I think chances are in the beginning we'll probably just do our own site and Steam. Obviously not getting onto Steam's pretty rough for an indie game. But, you know, we'll look into the alternatives. I haven't heard a whole lot about the others that makes them sound super compelling. But I also have heard that being on as many platforms as you possibly can is always good.
Yep, definitely. And my last question, one of the things that we see post-Kickstarter are a lot of companies that allow people to basically buy into the beta or buy into the alpha afterwards. With Arsons, do you think that you'll have some kind of feature with that, that people who haven't Kickstarter will be able to play the game early? Or is it right now just going to be locked to backers until you get to public?
We will have, you know, if we can get onto Steam, one of those buy the game and get the pre-alpha version or the alpha version. And, you know, all subsequent versions as well. But we definitely want to give our Kickstarter backers the first run at all of that and only open it up to the public or the public once we feel like we've given the Kickstarter backers that exclusivity that they pledged into.
All right. I think that will do it for this week's edition of the Set the Podcast. Charles, it was great talking to you again.
Yeah, always good to be here.
And hopefully next time we have you on, you'll have a finished or released version of RSNs for us to gush about.
Yes, that'll be great.
All right, so with that, we're going to end it here. As always, I like to end the cast with saying that if you are interested in being a future guest or would like to write a guest piece for the site, feel free to send us an email. You can find the link and information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. With that said, thank you for listening to the Preset the Podcast here on Game Wisdom. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.